They broke all of their own protocols.
But weren't they mostly sent up in directions away from the
There you go. Board? Yeah, yes. And they sent one jet. They turned one jet around and sent it after one fighter to go track down.
They were already on drills and exercises that had already taken them out and basically left the Eastern Seaboard.
Yes.
And this is supposed to be the smartest military in the world, right?
Yeah, yeah. There you go. Exactly. Well, it was embarrassment.
Well, I think that was putting someone into prison or something like this.
Well, other than me and the guy who was allegedly flying the plane that was involved in the shooting down 93, who they don't want you to know about, who's been, who was held in prison for a couple of years at least. And I don't know if he's out or not. I mean, they gave him a real hard time.
Yeah. Susan, could you remind me again what the sanctions were for in Iran? And two questions. And then I just wanted to get clear about what you were arrested for.
Good. The sanctions were on to punish Iraq for allegedly having weapons of mass destruction. And they said that they would keep the sanctions on Iraq until all weapons of mass destruction were confirmed to have been destroyed. Now, it appears that they were actually destroyed by the end of 96 or 97, but the United States had an ulterior agenda, which was they were not going to let go of the sanctions until Saddam was out of power. But what had happened was, by the year 2000, while Bill Clinton was still in office, the international loathing for sanctions had become intense. 2 million people had died from sanctions. Between 1.7 million and 2.2 million had died. And the international community was violating the sanctions. The German pilots were filed, and Jordanian pilots were filed, and actually it was coming from all over Europe. Germany was the first, and they had pilots fly humanitarian supplies over the air through sovereign airspace and land at Baghdad airport, and then a whole bunch of other countries followed suit, and they were all like, we're not going to do this. This is wrong. It is immoral. It is a crime against humanity, and we recognize that. And so at that point, the CIA, I wanted to do it, but at that point, the CIA knew that they were losing control of the situation and that they better step in and do something. And I wanted to end the sanctions, so I was glad the pilots were doing this. But the CIA was very, very expedient. It was politically expedient. They were losing control of the situation. They wanted to take back their power. I was accused of several things. One, I was accused of acting as an unregistered Iraqi agent because I had delivered a letter to my cousin, who was the chief of staff to George Bush, telling him that the war in Iraq would be catastrophic and begging him and outlining several of the consequences, like democracy would throw power to Islamic fundamentalists and there would be a rise of terrorist attacks, and the Iraqi people hated the sanctions and they would hate America for having done all this, and if they could get their hands on America, it would just be a very ugly, brutal occupation, and they'd fight us. That was my letter. I went to jail for that. And they also accused me they called it unlawful financial transactions. I was accused, I'm not making this up, of allegedly eating three lunches with Iraqi diplomats totaling $92.92. We have the receipts. And they called that a felony. I was accused there were secret charges against me, which we have deduced. We were never allowed to know what they were. See, on the Patriot Act, let me just tell you a little bit, because I think this is a good opportunity to explain. When I was indicted, under the Patriot Act, they're allowed to have secret charges and secret evidence and secret grand jury testimony. This is very much, the Patriot Act is modeled on the pretty much verbatim, in many page upon page, identical to the old communist criminal, There's a long name for it. The Soviet Criminal Act, which set up the KGB apparatus and allowed people to make false make accusations against their neighbors without identifying themselves. And it set up the whole gulag system. And the Patriot Act is modeled on that Soviet law, the Soviet Criminal Act. And it's, you know, almost verbatim to what that is. So, I mean, this is a really scary, scary law. But I was accused of, like, possibly, in the secret charges, we believe the secret charges was that I received a book from the Iraqis that was a book on depleted uranium. And that was considered classified because if we were to tell American soldiers about the health risks and the rise of cancer rates and birth defects, then it might demoralize American soldiers. Okay? And another thing was is that Saddam's government tried, I'm not making this up, another secret charge was that we believe, well, because I know what I was doing in the periods when I, of these, like, different, they'd have a date, and I would know approximately what I was doing on that date. And so another one was that the Iraqis tried to give the Bush administration several $100,000 in campaign contributions so that during the presidential election, because they wanted to show that they wanted to be friends with America. And I was ordered, I had reported that to my defense intelligence handler. He was like, holy sh**, you got to tell the Iraqis not to do this. You got to make them not do this. And because it reminded them all of the Asian fundraising crisis under Clinton. And he said, don't they watch from C-SPAN? Don't they know they're not supposed to do this? And he said, you go back and you tell them that if we find out they gave money to the Republican Party in this campaign, we're going to bomb them. We're going to, you know, but see, at this point, Iraq had been bombed so many times, you couldn't threaten them with bombing anymore because they'd already been attacked. What? How are you going to, like, impress on people who, oh, you're going to bomb us again, okay.
This is kind of a rewind to earlier in the talk, but I just wanted to know how you knew that Mohammed Atta was a CIA asset.
That's been very well established. They've admitted that he was a CIA asset.
Now, I feel I should inject a note of caution here. I'm not sure exactly whom Susan Lindauer is suggesting admitted that Mohammed Atta was a CIA asset, presumably the CIA themselves. Well, that struck me as an extraordinary claim. Not that he was a CIA asset, I think that's highly likely, but the fact that they had actually admitted it. And possibly I've suffered my own intelligence failure, but my quick trawl of the internet failed to find that admission if it had indeed happened.
Can you send it to, like, a reference or something so I'd be able to verify that? Can you find something?
I will find a reference for you and give it to these guys and yeah, sure. I'll get you some references on that. But it has been verified that he was.
Good practice by the questioner asking for some references if someone makes an extraordinary claim. I can fault her only on failing to press Susan Lindauer on who exactly had admitted what exactly.
And you received some military training too. Sorry.
So, you know, I look in the audience here, we're pretty old. Do you go to I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Do you go to universities or high schools or because, you know, young people can steer things up, you know, and do some major changes, you know? Do you do that or they say, no, you can't?
Well, actually, I've really just started doing this because my book came out just 6 months ago. And so I've done a lot of radio, and I've done a lot of blogging, and which is more youth, I guess, more younger. I don't know if that's not fair. That's not really fair to say that it's younger people. But I do a lot of radio and a lot of new media stuff.
How about college campuses?
I would love to do that. This is really my first kind of book tour. But I would love to go to college campuses. I'm just kind of figuring out how to do it. Because part of the problem is the corporate media will not cover my story at all. Even when I was locked up in prison, one of my favorite stories, I know you guys all love Amy Goodman, but Amy Goodman told my, Amy Goodman, oh, okay. Yeah, well, you gotta hear what she did to me. When I was locked up, my boyfriend called her and talked to her producers and said, please, you know, Susan is the cousin of the chief of staff to the president. She covered the Iraqi embassy. She warned about 9/11. She's locked up on a military base on the Patriot Act, and they're refusing to give her a hearing. And she was the chief asset covering Iraqi pre-war intelligence. The government is saying that she's incompetent, and they're saying that that assets were incompetent. And yet she's accused, and he gave her the letter, the Andicard letter, and said, you know, she wrote this letter, and she turned out it was right on all fronts, and couldn't you please interview her? Couldn't you do a story? Please help us. And she, you know what she did? She said, well, you know, maybe her attorney thinks this is a good strategy. We wouldn't want to upset things for settling the case.
She'd been told to stay away from the story.
Yeah, but you know, she did. She took it, she did it herself, and she's to blame for it. And I will tell you, I will never forgive Amy Goodman for that. And my boyfriend was like in tears. He was weeping. I mean, he was a military. He was a retired Navy guy. And you guys, you know, Navy guys don't, I mean, you know men. You know, he's like, some men don't cry. He cried. He broke down in tears. And you know, men, it's hard for sometimes. For some men, not all men, some men cry. I know that, but he did. He was really upset, and he was just like, she won't do this, and he was just like heartbroken. And he was heartbroken for me, and he was just like, and I was locked up in prison at the time, and I'm on the prison phone, what the f*** do you mean Amy Goodman won't do this? How could she not think this is the right story? What did you say to her to make her not do this story? And he was like, I don't know. I told her. I said, did you say this and this and this? And he said, yeah.
Yeah, I heard you on the Jeff Prince program last week.
On Libya.
On Libya. So that's very similar, isn't it, to what's happening in Iraq.
There is no reason for the United States to be invading Libya at all. There is no justification for this. It's ironic because we're fighting Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Iraq, and Libya is actually, the Libyan rebels are radical Islamists who are trying to institute Sharia. And whether you like Sharia or whether you like the Islam, whether you like Gaddafi or not, see, this is where it gets you, you're an asset. Whether you like Gaddafi, you may hate him, you may think he's bad, but the facts are that the rebels are Islamic radicals. They do want to institute Sharia, and at least be honest and say it, because that's what you're going to get. And don't pretend you're somewhere else. Don't pretend these are people who are doing something different than what you say. That is what their goal is. And they don't want democracy. Gaddafi has been in power for 41 years, and I know it's time for change, but he has also had a tremendous track record on women's rights. They do not have to wear the abaya. They are free not to get married if they don't want to. They are free to get, women are free to get divorces if they want. And the kind, when we talk about Sharia, what I mean is that the Libyan rebels want the women to wear the burqa. An abaya is the burqa where they cover their hair and stuff. They don't have to do that now. They're going to have to do it in the future. They do not want the women to have the right to reject marriage proposals. Under Gaddafi's government, they have an imam actually visits the women before a marriage and sits them with them privately, which is really unheard of, and makes sure that the women are not being pressured into a marriage. And if the woman says that, young woman says that she is being pressured, the imam is, under the law of Libya, the imam has to protect the woman from the abuse of the relatives. And so he has to give her a chance to reject the marriage when nobody is there to pressure her to do it. Because this is what happens in Islamic families. Right now, there is a counter-coup going on in Libya, in Benghazi, and there's all kinds of dramatic stuff that's happening. So Gaddafi's...
strikes on each other.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that's true. So, but it's still, it's you know, so...
Hasn't Gaddafi been a pretty good ally for the West in recent years?
Absolutely.
So why is NATO supporting the rebels if they're in favor of Sharia? I don't understand why NATO is supporting...
It is very interesting. Gaddafi has Libyan oil costs $1 per barrel to produce, and the United States had preferential contracts already. The United States and France and Britain all had, they could take as much oil as they wanted, And most of the oil does not come to the United States. It does, however, go to Italy and France and Britain. So it's a major source of European oil. And yet, what Gaddafi was doing was, Gaddafi also has gold. And I think it's very interesting that we have this major financial crisis, and now we're attacking a country that has both oil and a huge private reserve of gold on its own land, and like 500, I would have to double check this fact, but it's like 500 tons of gold in its bank vaults.
143.
143, I stand corrected. 143 tons of gold, correct?
Something like that.
And we're trying to take their gold and their oil. And it's so dirty. It's a dirty fight, and it's just...
Why would these radical fundamentalists want to let us have the oil and the gold once they win?
Well, you should be in Washington. That's the kind of thing that makes sense. But that's what they... You know, the Americans are choosing to believe that they're going to have this sweetheart deal. And I am agreeing with you. I think that as soon as they get in, they're going to say, you know, too bad. It's like, and privately, I get emails from some of these, I mean, because they know me, that they know that I'm out there, I'm against the rebels. And they do send me, I do get emails that are very nasty emails. And they said, do you really think we'll sell out and give you our gold for free? Do you really think we're going to do that? And I'm like, well, I think that Hillary Clinton thinks you're going to do it. And I think that you know, David Cameron in Britain thinks you're going to do it. And also, I do have documentation that Israel has promised. I actually have an Israeli military document, okay, in Hebrew that I've had translated. And it says that the Israelis are, and okay, this is just what it says, that this is a primary document, and I have, it says that Israel will provide financial support to the rebels in exchange for a military base in Libya, in the Green Mountains. And that they call it, the military base will be called One by One. And the Green Mountains is where, close to where the gold is, which I find very interesting.
I'm very interested in your constitution, how you're dealing with all of this. I've been really impressed with all the interviews I've heard, and you seem to be like a really grounded, confident, yet buoyant person. And I don't know. Hearing what you have, like a sense of humor and the sense of irony, I like to think I have that. But how do people go through what you've gone through? Like, all you know, are people we know being called into grand jury, being put into what's that detention called with
the communication center detention? That is a very scary.
And Bradley Manning, like when it gets that bad, like how can we be sure that people can still stand up and talk like you are today?
Well, I'll tell you, when I was locked up in Carswell, I cried every day. And when I first went in, I was told it was going to be 4 months and then I'd be released. And the first 4 months, I was okay. Because I was like, I'm going to get out of this, and I'm going to tell, and boy, am I going to have a story to tell, and they're not going to shut me up. But when they refused to release me, and I realized that I was not going home, and they said, and at that point, they dropped the bomb on me that they were trying to hold me indefinitely. And only when I thought I was going to be held indefinitely, and then that continued for another 8 months, I became absolutely terrified out of my mind. And I began to have very serious post-traumatic stress.
Well, you were saying you had gone through depression before, and I was just wondering how...
I went through deep anxiety, and I was just... It was like my blood pressure was... The stress level was like, it was like a war, a constant war. I was so frightened. I actually colored my hair, okay? My hair actually went white.
So you had contact with people you needed to have contact with?
No, and I'll tell you something. I was locked in prison, and they would not let at that point I had a public attorney who made no effort to get me out. And my uncle, who, God bless his heart, lived in Illinois, was driving 700 miles. He was an attorney, though. He had 40 years of experience in corporate law. So he was not a criminal attorney, but he'd had a very good, he was an outstanding attorney. He read the law. He read up on my type of law. He studied what I needed to do. and to get move out of the situation. And he made three efforts to see me. But because I was in locked up in a, what they call a, now they're calling a communication center. Yeah, scary, scary people. Yeah, they and all the political prisoners, all the women political prisoners are being held in Carswell. So if any of you guys are ever arrested on the Patriot Act, you'll be seeing the inside of Carswell too. But they don't have to let the attorneys onto the base. And so my even though he was both family and an attorney, and he was coming on visiting hours, he was showing up when he, you know, when other family members were allowed on the base. Like if you were in prison and you would be able to have your family members show up, he wasn't asking for any special privileges. We filled all the forms. It was all reported correctly. He would show up at the base and they would say, you're going to see that Iraqi agent. You are not coming into our base. No, there is no prison here. And then they said there was no visiting hours on the weekends. And other people were going right around him and they said, you can go in, you can go in, you are not going in. And he drove 700 miles in each direction. And believe it or not, there's an affidavit from him in the back of my book. And so it's all, what I'm telling you is confirmed. It's like, it sounds extraordinary, but it is confirmed. But how did I keep my spirits up? I was terrorized. I was absolutely frightened out of my wits. And it was such a, you know, I'm just jubilant that it's over. That it's just, you know, it's just, I had a wonderful... I did have a wonderful, loving companion who died. He died 2 days after the court granted my request for a hearing. For 4 years, we lived together, and he fought for me to have that hearing. And then as soon as we got, he had cancer at the end. And as soon as he found out that we had the hearing, he died. 2 days, he didn't even live 48 hours after that. And so then I had to have the hearing without him. And that was like very traumatic, but he always had this attitude that was really cool, which was, you know, he hated self-pity, and he wasn't going to tolerate it. And he was like, you know, you chose your values, and you have to, you know, and he had this attitude. He was like, you know, you chose your values, and when you believe in something, you have to be willing to pay the consequence, pay the price for your values, and you have to take your consequences. And he said, you should be, if you really believe in what you did, then you should be proud of yourself, and don't let these people take this away from you. So that was his attitude. So.
Just one last question.
Sure.
I'm just not familiar with the word asset. And Robin asked that question too. Okay. Can you just help me clarify what that really is? Is that like a secretary?
Oh, no. An asset is like an operative. It's like a field operative. A human asset is the eyes and ears that goes into the situation, into the room, and has direct contact with events. So assets are very, that's why assets are trained to be very, we are trained to be very observant of the full situation and to be very descriptive of what we're doing. And not we're trained not to change what we've seen for any reason. And that was a real threat to the Bush administration, because it's just like you don't ever change your story. Because the detail that you think is small, that you think you might compromise, could turn out to be very important because you are compartmentalized. And you're like seeing a picture of this. And they need to know what this is. They need to see what you see right here. Even if you don't know what's over there or what's over there, they have to know that this here that you're reporting is as accurate and precise as possible. Yeah, except that basically, with the exception in this situation, that the Libyans and the Iraqis both knew who I was from the first day that we went in. And the reason that the Libyans knew immediately, once I told the Libyans, it was over. I mean, you can't ever take it back. And that was that my CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuse, was involved in the Lockerbie case, and he wanted to be a witness testifying in the Lockerbie case. And so we were starting, before I ever went to the Iraqis, we started talks for the Lockerbie trial with Libya, and we wanted the Libyans to know that if they would accept the trial, that his testimony would help exonerate their people. So then I had to tell them who I was. And so they knew. But I remember the first conversation I had with Mr. Amara at the Libyan embassy. He's like, we want to know why you are here. This is a very important question. It requires a very important answer. And so he was like, we want to know, what the heck are you doing? Because you people just didn't, in 1995, when I established contact with the Libya House, people just didn't wander into the Libya House. Believe me. You know, and if I had not been an asset, the FBI would have arrested me the minute I came out of there. You know, so they were told not to touch me. So
after you were locked up for a year, and then it was 5 years total that you weren't allowed to say anything?
Well, 5 years I was under indictment.
Okay.
So when you're under indictment, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. However, what they had done was very clever, because when I was released from prison, the corporate media told everybody I was crazy. I had been declared, quote, incompetent to stand trial. And so I must be, you know, there must be something really wrong with me, so most people wouldn't listen to what I had to say anyway.
So what happens in the next 4 years? And then did anybody say anything when you were starting to come out with this? And have you ever heard from anybody at your Mr. whatever his name is at the CIA again?
Well, very good questions. I was actually under indictment for 18 months before I got sent to prison, and then I was held for a year. So when I'm released from prison, that's actually the halfway mark of my case. Then I found another attorney, and it took him about another 18 months. It took try to understand what I'm saying to you. 2.5 years I'm under indictment, and I'm released from prison. For another 18 months, the court refuses to grant me a hearing after I've been released from prison. Because I get another attorney, he says, I can take her case. I can work with this woman. As far as I'm concerned, she is competent to help me assist in this defense. She is capable of assisting in her own defense if I'm taking it. He went into court. He stood in front of the judge. He assured the judge that he could work with me. This was not going to be a problem. Because the reason anyone's declared incompetent is if they're not capable of helping their attorney in the case.
What kind of court was it?
U.S. Federal Court, Southern District of New York. The first judge was Judge Michael Mukasey. He then retired, and a new judge took over, Loretta Preska. Her husband worked for Daddy Bush.
There's a surprise. What happened until now?
Oh, and then we did have the hearing in June of 2008. Right before the presidential election in November. And we had begun doing radio to people like Michael Herzog at Oracle Broadcasting, Republic Broadcasting. The internet radio was giving me a lot of attention, and they were helping to defend me. And when we had my witness testified in court about the 9/11 warnings, then it exploded out more. But again, but on the internet, people who like pay attention to the internet do know this story, and then they began to talk about it a lot more. But then my case continued another year, and my CIA handler, I'm told, has said that he's very sorry for he thinks it's really a shame what they did to me. He feels sorry for me. He does not feel sorry for what he did, but he says that I'm very sorry that they screwed Susan. But he didn't give me any money for my legal defense.
Did you hear anything from anybody about the book?
Oh, when I do radio interviews, there are funny things that happen. Like my phone will cut out, and it'll just go dead. Like I make sure that I have my batteries charged and all this stuff, and the phone will just drop out, and just the battery will just disappear. Or if they can't kill the phone call, sometimes there will be like a loud beeping noise. Beep. Beep, beep, and all the way like through an hour interview without stop. It'll just continue all the way through.
Directly came up and threatened your publisher?
Well, I have had to self-publish it.
Okay.
Because the corporate press was like, they're like, no one wants to hear about 9/11. No one wants to hear this. And then we were afraid. We did have some smaller publishers who were willing to take it, but we were very much afraid at that point that a smaller publisher would be threatened and then they would close the book and they'd stop it. And so I decided that the safest way to go forward would be to self-publish it, and with my hopefully, you know, by the time you realize I've got 700 footnotes, I've got the documents in here, I've got, you know, the affidavits in there, and now I'm safe because no one has sued me, no one's threatened to sue me, and so hopefully in the future, if I write a second book, then hopefully they'll pick up this one and both of them will be distributed.
Now, you may be wondering just what evidence the U.S. judges had for adjudicating Susan Lindauer to be unable to stand trial. You might also, I suppose, be wondering whether if the original claim was that she was working with foreign governments to undermine the security of U.S. citizens, what justification there could be, having decided that she was mentally unbalanced, for letting her go. Whether she was going to be any less of a threat because of her claimed mental instability. I suspect you may also be wondering just whether those individuals who decided to lock her up or adjudicate her as mentally fit or unfit were in any sense accountable for their actions, and I suspect the answer is no. The use of the mental health system for political purposes by officials of the government of the Soviet Union is fairly well understood and fairly well known. In the West, its use by American, Canadian, other governments of the West is fairly poorly understood, in my experience. The most recent case which came to my attention is that of Kevin Galilee, a student of politics at Oxford and then Leicester, whose opinions ran counter to those of his course tutor, and, Kevin Galilee says, counter to those of the government agent in his course, whom he personally identifies, and whose mission, he says, was to monitor the intellectual debate and steer it in a direction favourable to the powers that be. This he links to a UK government programme called Contest, running since 2007, to prevent radicalisation and the spreading of the wrong sort of ideas in UK higher education. Now, I have friends in the academic profession who have been contacted by the Secret Services, and the UK government admits that there is such a programme, but doesn't feel the need to disclose any more details. And is it just coincidence that the Canadian authorities have deemed Mr. Galilee to be mentally unbalanced? Well, we're not going to get to the bottom of this in this show. If you'd like to do some more reading, you can do so on the Wiki Spooks website, which I shall link in from this show's webpage. I was going to do more on mental health this episode. Then I heard the following talk by Ian Henschel at the 2011 conference on state crimes against democracy. And I thought, well, this is such a good fit with what Susan Lindauer was talking about that I thought I should fit it into the same episode. And this is the soundtrack of a YouTube video, which is available for download from the show's webpage.
I'll just build up to this in a slightly roundabout way. There are really three ways that we're hoping to sort of get them, so to speak, for 9/11. One is the foreign media and the internet, and that's doing quite well. I mean, the internet's always done well for us, and the foreign media increasingly are beginning to sort of crumble and go with general world opinion, which is that 9/11 quite likely was an inside job. So that's going quite well as well. And of course, here in Britain, we're going to be the last to see that because, you know, London and Washington, you know, as discussed here, are absolutely, you know, like they're inseparable, not to mention Tel Aviv. So we're not noticing that much, but I promise you it is happening. And then you've got the second line of attack has been the forensic issues. Richard Gates' brilliant sort of campaign to bring artists and engineers on for 9/11 Truth. And I think the important thing there is that your average architect, I mean, I can't prove this, but we had some work done on our house and an engineer came in and he wasn't chosen for any other reason that he was going to do some work on our house. He was actually very sceptical about 9/11. Somehow this guy in Hove had discovered, just a typical guy, so far as I could see, had discovered that, yeah, you know, this is a very suspect story. We're getting the same sort of reports from the Royal Institute of British Architects. So that's all going pretty well. However, There is a problem with forensic issues, which Michael Rupert, who was an early researcher into 9/11, put his finger on. He was an ex-policeman, and he basically said, with forensic issues, you can always find an expert who is going to say whatever you pay them to say, especially if they're they're getting lots of research grants from you, and we're seeing that with Purdue University seem to be prepared to provide limitless, apparent computerized, justifications of why the official story at the Pentagon's true, why the towers collapsed. So that is the problem with forensic issues. You can always get, especially if you're the government and paying so much money, so much control of the economy now, you can always get somebody to say anything you want. And that's always going to be a problem with the forensic issues. And then you've got the paper trail. Now, at first sight, the paper trail looks like pretty hopeless. A, you've got to do a lot of reading. The average, Inspector General's report in the United States probably comes out at about, 150 pages. And there's lots of it now. Secondly, it takes a bit of explaining. It doesn't have pictures. It's just all about statements and affidavits and things like that and investigations and what was this in this email. So, you can, with the sort of short-term attention span that we all have nowadays, I set myself so you all have nowadays, just a joke, it doesn't really do very well on the internet, the paper trail. Although actually, in a sense, it's benefiting from the internet because we can now all read these released documents without having to actually literally travel to Washington and go to the particular library to look at them. Anyway, the paper trail really started with the first FBI officers who complained that they'd tried to investigate 9/11 and they'd been stopped by their superiors. And that was actually a very big story. Colleen Rowley was made Woman of the Year, but the story became incompetence, predictably. Incompetence, lost emails, too busy with other things. But actually, it was about three different FBI officers who were all saying the same thing, So then the story became, that just means a lot of incompetence. And it was all actually on the desk of the same guy in FBI headquarters. All these things got lost, and he had to say how he'd forgotten to read this email and didn't realise the significance of this report. And this was, of course, connected mainly with the case of Zacharias Moussaoui, who was alleged to be the 20th hijacker, who had been arrested, and very likely was. He wanted to fly planes, he didn't want to land them. And, of course, that brings us on to just one other problem with the paper trail. People who think that the whole 9/11 story is utterly, utterly false from beginning to end, it was drone planes, or maybe there weren't even any planes, or all those sort of lines of attack, they don't like to hear about the paper trail, because the paper trail actually indicates much more what you could call the ringleader and patsy explanation. In other words, they did produce a few Islamic radicals who would have liked to have carried out 9/11, but they helped them. They needed help because they actually could never have done it themselves. They couldn't fly planes, they couldn't operate in America without getting caught, as in the case of Zacharias Moussaoui, who did get caught. The issue is really, do you think that they can, would you rather, if you were in the CIA organising all this, let's say for the sake of argument it was the CIA organising, I think it probably was, would you rather have a completely fake event with fake passengers, fake planes? Surely, in the modern world, that's a bit of a risk. What happens if the Russians manage to take some pictures of your fake planes and show that they're actually cruise missiles or whatever? So I've personally always thought that, the complete fakery explanation probably isn't the way to go, although you can't rule anything out. But those guys hate paper trail researchers such as me, because they say that we're sort of substantiating, libel against Muslims. I mean, the fact is that there are quite a lot of radical, angry radical Muslims who would have liked to have carried out 9/11. And I personally think it's, I'm sorry if I'm insulting anybody's opinion here. I personally think it's stupid to say that that isn't the case. So anyway, we had our FBI offices, three of them. So at that point, I was writing my first book, and I went off to a friend of mine who I'll call G, who I knew at Oxford, and he now works, he has worked in sort of serious crime investigations, sort of major international criminal networks. And I said to him, hey, gee, I said, he totally believes the official story of 9/11, this guy, which is very useful, so it's best not to have arguments necessarily with people and get their back up. I've never really argued with him about it because he's so dyed-in-the-wool type. And I said, hey, you know, well, how do you explain these FBI officers? Easy, he said. That's always what happens when there's another squad that's chasing somebody. So, you know, if you're chasing a gang of drug smugglers, the last thing you want is for them to get accidentally arrested by some other coppers who might only catch them with 1 kilo of cannabis when you're just planning to catch them with 50 tons of cannabis. So, you know, that is always what happens. If there's a major investigation on, a little flag gets put on people's computer records. And the famous Oxford and English drug smuggler Howard Marks classically benefited from this. And if you ever do want to sort of get away with petty crime, just set yourself up as a major crime figure and you will get a free pass. You'll get a free pass through borders, you'll get a free pass if you ever are arrested, because a little thing comes up saying, keep your hands off him. So this is what obviously was happening with these FBI officers. But there's a big problem, because where was this other investigation that was used as a justification for closing down the FBI investigations, especially when you consider that the FBI was legally responsible for all investigations within the US, and indeed President Clinton put the FBI in charge of all global, that's been forgotten now, all global anti-terrorism actions. So they were even active in Yemen when the USS Cole was bombed, allegedly by Al-Qaeda. So, you know, where was this? Who was it who took the FBI off the case illegally, as far as we can see? Maybe there was a secret. I mean, the president could have done it. Cheney could have done it. They could have issued directives saying, take the FBI off the case. And once again, we end up with the finger pointing at Cheney and the president. You know, you can't have a guy in the FBI deciding that, or a guy in the CIA. It has to go to the president, as far as I understand. So, where was this investigation? Obviously, they didn't stop the 9/11 attacks happening, because they happened. And funnily enough, actually, the alleged hijackers all bought their tickets in advance. So, you know, whoever told the FBI not to get on the case, because they've got a better case, they didn't even notice that we have to believe that they didn't even notice that all these hijackers were all buying their tickets for morning of the 11th of September, all on planes, you know, from different places, all flying at the same time. So, and that's just not credible. You know, at the very least, you need to know why that is. And frankly, you know, for most people in the world by now, if they really think about that, it's bloody obvious, you know, that this plot was protected. And then, of course, you get to the question of how the guys could have flown the planes. And, you know, it's not easy to fly planes like that. And most of us think that somehow there must have been some sort of remote control element in it, because otherwise they wouldn't have succeeded. So that's how far we got at the time I wrote my book. Well, of course, you know, nobody listens to me, especially not in the mainstream media. But interestingly, you know, the evidence was there of how the CIA had deliberately, the Osama bin Laden unit of the CIA, which was never announced. I mean, at the time of 9/11, they all went on TV, oh, we lost interest in Afghanistan, this is a blowback, what a pity we let Afghanistan rot after we kicked the Russians out. Osama bin Laden, well, we knew a little bit about him, we never imagined, you know, but now we've just realised that Al-Qaeda is a huge organisation, huge, terrible threat to us. Nobody actually mentioned that there was an 80-person strong unit of the CIA, which had the same status as a CIA country station. So something perhaps of the size of the Jordanian station of the CIA was entirely devoted to Osama bin Laden. It was called the Osama bin Laden unit. It was only 2 years later that we had got any corroboration of that from the 9/11 Commission report. So we got the Osama bin Laden unit. And then in the 9/11 Commission report, you see, some people said, oh, don't bother to read it, load of rubbish, you know, it's just all made up by Philip Zelikow. Sort of true. However, if you follow the more cock-uppy sort of approach, which I personally do, and you think, well, they can't all be crooks at every level, everywhere in the US government. Maybe some honest people got onto the 9/11 Commission, maybe just by accident, and obviously not by design, you know, but just at the medium level, perhaps. Or just people with grudges against other departments or whatever. So I had a really good look. I read every footnote. And it turns out now, the story has come out, that Zelikow, who wrote the report, basically, he's just a fantasist. His expertise is in the construction of historical legend, I think is how it's put. But Zelikow, you know, was a very busy guy. He was a bit hyperactive. He was busy making illegal phone calls to the White House, which he promised he wouldn't make, informing the White House of the progress of the investigation. He was their snitch, basically, and he was running the investigation. But he was very busy in the last few days. And into the footnotes, the dissident people on the 9/11 Commission actually managed to insert information into the footnotes, which was devastatingly damaging to the CIA. And they, in particular, there was one person who flat out lied about legal advice that they'd had, which said that they couldn't pass on some information to the FBI. It was a flat out lie. The legal advice was pretty much the opposite of what she'd been given. And just to show that she wasn't stupid, this helpful little person in the 9/11 Commission mentioned in the footnote that when she copied on this advice to everybody saying you can't pass on the information to the FBI, the only person she failed to copy it to was the person she was claiming was the source of the advice. Now, you know, how many coincidences are we expected to believe in? Obviously, this was the point at which, you know, in a possibly illegal and certainly very wrong way, the FBI, and there's actually millions of cases of that, but we didn't know any more of them until relatively recently, when there's been a flood of releases of official documentation. What we now know from the Inspector General's reports, because America does have a system which is supposed to work, you know, it's not entirely hopeless. It doesn't work because of presidential fiat just undermines everything else, and the war necessity argument undermines everything else, but actually, they do have these Inspector General's offices in these places like the CIA and the Pentagon. And, you know, they do go through some sort of motions of making investigations, and half of it gets redacted, and half of them are engaged in the cover-up. But little bits and pieces come out. It's very difficult to stop little things coming out. You know, there's that old Victorian saying, you know, what webs we tangled webs we weave when we practice to deceive. And it's absolutely true. It's very difficult to tell lies in a consistent way when there's any scrutiny at all going on. So basically, what we now know, due to a guy called Kevin Fenton, who's done an absolutely heroic job of reading through all these things, is that there was an utterly undeniable, very consistent, organised decision in the CIA to protect the 9/11 hijackers. And the closer it got to 9/11, the more adamant Osama bin Laden, funnily enough, became at telling the hijackers to go ahead. And of course, some people think that Osama bin Laden is the most successful CIA agent of all time, and not just fantasists. You know, the people in Pakistan will tell you that. I know a guy who told me that just recently, who apparently knew the family. But anyway, the nearer it got to September 11th, the more desperate everybody became to get ahead with the hijacks before these guys all got rolled up, because it was a really close thing. The FBI was so angry, they're having shouting matches, they're finding out. The CIA was entirely sussed on Al-Qaeda, if it even was independent from the CIA. They had their main communications hub bugged by them and the National Security Agency. They monitored the planning session for 9/11, which happened in Malaysia. They were reporting back to the White House. But the only people, the people who should have known about this, were always kept in the dark, the FBI. As 9/11 approached, the FBI got hotter and hotter onto the trail. There were screaming, shouting matches, threats of legal action. All shit was breaking loose in 2 weeks before 9/11. They still wouldn't give the FBI the information they needed, which would have stopped the 9/11 attacks. And, you know, the rest is history. Kevin Fenton's told us the story. It's a very heavy book. You know, I don't particularly recommend it to people who aren't interested in paper trail sort of issues. Any lawyer should read that book. It's a masterpiece. And now what we've had is Richard Clarke, who was the head of... This is all the build-up to the amazing news, which, of course, the media aren't disseminating because it doesn't fit their pre-judge story. We've had Richard Clarke, who was the anti-terror coordinator in the White House. And we've got Ali Soufan, who was the lead FBI investigator. Ali Soufan says, 2 days after 9/11, the CIA gave me the dossier I've been asking for months and months and months, and I went off and retched. This goes beyond incompetence. That's what he said. It's all on the record. Der Spiegel, you know, it's not even on dodgy internet, allegedly dodgy internet. So it's right on the record, undeniable. If you know anybody who works at The Guardian or on BBC, undeniable. And not only has Ali Soufan said that from the FBI end, but Richard Clarke, who was in charge of the CIA at the White House. I mean, that was where the only legal way that the CIA was supposed to be communicating with the White House, their masters, was through Richard Clarke. Richard Clarke has also said, they never told me anything. He said, they told me every bloody little detail. They told me that there was a big attack coming. They never told me any of the absolutely vital information that they knew exactly what the alleged hijackers were up to, or at least some of them were up to. So, you know, the CIA has now got a hell of a lot to answer for. First of all, they blamed it for 5 years on the FBI's alleged incompetence. Bullshit. Then they get their friendly internet sites. I'm afraid I disagree with Tony Hall about this. to say it was Israel who did it as another distraction. Then they get the corporate media to say it was Saudi Arabia who did it. The place to start, in my opinion, I'm speaking as a researcher here, not as, you know, Reinvestigate 9/11, because we don't really have a fixed opinion in Reinvestigate 9/11. As a researcher, I'm saying the place to start is the CIA. The paper trail's there. All we now have to do is to get, maybe if there are any journalists of integrity left in the heavyweight parts of the newspapers, they've got the story. The story is there. You know, it really is there. And we can now say that there was an agreement in the CIA to allow the 9/11 attacks to go ahead. They might not have intended them to happen in the way they did, but there was an agreement made in the CIA. There was a conspiracy. There was an agreement in the CIA. And that is now, we were right, and the sneerers and, you know, people who call us conspiracy theorists were wrong. There was a conspiracy in the CIA.
Now, thanks to reinvestigate911.org for that video. There's more of the same ilk if you go to their website. Now, I'm not expecting the American government to be interested in reinvestigating 9/11 for the same reason that I wouldn't expect Fox to be interested in investigating a break into the hen house. If they're calling for more attention to be paid by citizens, then more power to them. I am expecting the perpetrators of 9/11 to be brought to some kind of justice, not state-sponsored justice, but citizens' direct action, bottom-up justice. Hard to say quite what form that would take, but I'm not thinking that the state and its alliance with the corporate apparatus could be fixed by a few crusading journalists. That's not to say I don't applaud Susan Lindauer, journalists who try and break the story, anybody who's doing something to get the truth out there. I see an intimate connection between the violence of the state to other states, and the hypocrisy needed to perpetrate that, and the violence of the state towards its own citizens, both of which, of course, highly accelerated in the decades since 9/11. We've just got time for a snippet of David Graeber, where we left off last time, in Chapter 7, where he touches on that momentous occasion when the state first decided that it had a duty to intervene in people's social relations. The most dramatic known attempt to solve the problem, Lerner observes, can be found in a Middle Assyrian law code from somewhere between 1400 and 1100 BC, which is also the first known reference to veiling in the history of the Middle East, and also, Lerner emphasizes, first to make the policing of social boundaries the responsibility of the state. It is not surprising that this takes place under the authority of perhaps the most notoriously militaristic state in the entire ancient Middle East. The code carefully distinguishes among five classes of women: respectable women, either married ladies or concubines, widows, and daughters of free Assyrian men, must veil themselves when they go out on the street. Prostitutes and slaves, and prostitutes are now considered to include unmarried temple servants, as well as simple harlots, are not allowed to wear veils. The remarkable thing about the laws is that the punishments specified in the code are not directed at respectable women who do not wear veils, but against prostitutes and slaves who do. The prostitute was to be publicly beaten 50 times with staves and have pitch poured on her head. The slave girl was to have her ears cut off. Free men, proven to have knowingly abetted an impostor, would also be thrashed and put to a month's forced labour. Presumably, in the case of respectable women, the law was assumed to be self-enforcing, as what respectable woman would wish to go out in the street in the guise of a prostitute? And when we refer to respectable women, then, we are referring to those whose bodies could not, under any conditions, be bought or sold. Their physical persons were hidden away and permanently relegated to some man's domestic sphere. When they appeared in public veiled, they were effectively still ostentatiously walking around, even in public, inside such a sphere. Women who could be exchanged for money, on the other hand, must be instantly recognizable as such. The Assyrian law code is one isolated instance. Veils certainly did not become obligatory everywhere after 1300 BC. But it provides a window on developments that were happening, however unevenly, even spasmodically, across the region, propelled by the intersection of commerce, class, defiant assertions of male honour, and the constant threat of the defection of the poor. States seem to have played a complex dual role, simultaneously fostering commoditization and intervening to ameliorate its effects, enforcing the laws of debt and rights of fathers, and offering periodic amnesties. But the dynamic also led, over the course of millennia, to a systematic demotion of sexuality itself from a divine gift, an embodiment of civilized refinement, to one of its more familiar associations, with degradation, corruption, and guilt. Here, I think, we have the explanation for that general decline of women's freedoms that may be observed in all the great urban civilizations for so much of their history. In all of them, similar things were happening, even if, in each case, the pieces came together in different ways. The history of China, for instance, saw continual and largely unsuccessful government campaigns to eradicate both bride price and debt slavery, and periodic scandals over the existence of markets in daughters, including the outright sale of girls as daughters, wives, concubines, or prostitutes, at the buyer's discretion, continue to this day. In India, the caste system allowed what were otherwise differences between rich and poor to be made formal and explicit. Brahmins and other members of the upper castes jealously sequestered their daughters and married them off with lavish dowries, while the lower castes practiced bride price, allowing members of higher, twice-born castes to scoff at them for selling their daughters. The twice-born were likewise largely protected from falling into debt peonage, while for much of the rural poor, debt dependency was institutionalized, with the daughters of poor debtors, predictably, often dispatched to brothels or to the kitchens or laundries of the rich. In either case, between the push of commoditization, which fell disproportionately on daughters, and the pull of those trying to reassert patriarchal rights to protect women from any suggestion that they might be commoditized, women's formal and practical freedoms appear to have been gradually but increasingly restricted and effaced. As a result, notions of honour change too, becoming a kind of protest against the implications of the market, even as, at the same time, like the world religions, they came to echo that market logic in endless subtle ways. Nowhere, however, are our sources as rich and detailed as they are for ancient Greece. This is partly because a commercial economy arrived there so late, almost 3,000 years later than in Sumer. As a result, classical Greek literature gives us a unique opportunity to observe the transformation as it was actually taking place. And that's where we leave David Graeber for this week. Last week I spoke to a friend on 9/11, and she hadn't thought that it could be an inside job. I probably said too much. I think just showing the video of the collapse of World Trade Center 7 and asking, "Well, do you believe the government's story that this is due to fire?" is enough. Any more details at that stage, I think, are worse than useless. The first step on which you should focus is helping people to overcome the emotional barrier to realizing just how egregiously they've been lied to. Now, this show is intended for people who are clear that there is something fishy going on and wanting to look into more details. If you're new to the show, there's another 46 episodes on the events of September the 11th, which you can access at unwelcomeguest.net/911. All previous episodes are also available for download from our archive, unwelcomeguest.net/archive.
There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.